The hour of 10:15 having arrived, we'll call the Committee on Taxes to order. Members, we have a full agenda today. We do not quite have a quorum at this time, so before we take any official action, we will make sure that we have a quorum here. But we will start out with the bills to see if there's any question. Then when we have a quorum, we'll come back and vote on them. The itinerary for today would be House File 247, House File 1084, House File 548 to be passed to either the floor or various other committees.
Are these always means?
Not 247, but 1084.
1084 would be Ways and Means, 247 would be the floor, and 548 is Ways and Means. Okay, and then we will get into...
We're going to send them to the General Register, sorry.
Okay, 548 General Register. Okay, House File 1231, then we will get into, that's the Governor's budget proposal, and we will take a look at that. And we have a lot of folks, and be my intention to get through the three bills as quickly as we can. And then what we will do is we will go, we're very fortunate today to have the new commissioner of the Department of Revenue with us and the assistant commissioner with us. They will make a brief, or the commissioner will make a brief presentation on the Paymar bill. And then what we will do, we will go then immediately into testimony from citizens, lobbyists, various folks that have signed up to testify regarding a House File 1231, either supporting the bill or parts of the bill, or expressing concerns on the entire bill or parts of the bill. So with that, when we do have a quorum, I will move House File 247 to the General Register. General Register, and I believe that there will be an amendment on that one, the A1 amendment. And do we have a quorum yet?
Yeah.
Okay. So basically, when we do have a quorum here, we will move House File 247. There will be an amendment, and we've heard that before. It's basically been laid over here in the committee. That's the one where if someone would like to make voluntary state contributions to the state. It lays out a process on how to do that, and the amendment clears up a few things there. Then we'll get into a bill that we've heard here, Wisconsin Reciprocity. We've talked about that at some length, and then Representative Bisgins will be presenting a bill for us here. I'll tell you what, why don't we, is Representative Bisgins here?
He'll be back in a second.
Okay. Okay, so with that, let's go to 247. If Mr. Michael could please explain the A1 amendment, what the A1 amendment would do, and again, we will not take official action until we have a quorum established.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, essentially the A1 amendment makes two changes in House File 247. The original bill as drafted had a blank in for the minimum contribution that would be required to participate in this program, and what the A1 amendment does is to set that at $10. And the second thing it does is it clarifies that there will not be an appropriation to fund the administrative costs of this, but that the department is to essentially cover that out of their general appropriations.
Okay. Okay. Members, we now have a quorum. We'll officially call the meeting to order. Representative Carlson moves the minutes of March 30th. Any questions on the minutes from the meeting of March 30th, 2011? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. I will now move House File 247 to be passed to the General Register. To get the bill in the shape that I would like, we have the A1 amendment that Mr. Michael just described. Any discussion? Hearing none. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Motion barely prevails. Okay. We discussion on the bill, House File 247. Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, maybe this is a question for staff, but my recollection is, we've heard bills like this before, and I thought that in current law, without a new bill, this is already the case that folks can give money to state government. And I understand you're setting up a process here to have the Department of Revenue get involved, but I think in current law, we already afford people this opportunity. And maybe it's a staff question, but I had been told that in the past, and I was just wondering if that was still the case or if something changed.
Mr. Michael, to the Lynchewski question.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lynchewski, yes, it is accurate that under current law, any individual that wants to make a contribution to state government, there is a mechanism for doing that through the Department of Management and Budget, or through other individual departments. This bill essentially sets up a mechanism whereby you could do that on your tax return, as opposed to sending it, you know, on your own initiative, sending a check or other money to MMB.
Representative Lynchewski.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that. And so I guess, you know, I'm understanding the intent then, Chair Davids, is that you have a little different idea here using the Department of Revenue. But, you know, I will recall that Governor Ventura, and you were here as well, set up a fund to let people pay for the Vikings if they want, the Twins if they wanted to, and I think almost nobody gave any money. And we might want to go back and look at that later this year as to what the outcome was when Minnesotans thought they should pay for a stadium. But that's an aside, an editorial comment. I do know that you're much more familiar with the health industry than I am. And I thought Governor Dayton just was working on don't sit on the health committee, that, you know, that some of the HMOs are going to give Minnesota now some revenue. And I think, you know, I'm not sure how this is all working, that we would want to have a tax, the Department of Revenue, and have an administrative cost to let people on their tax form do it. Can you just share with me your thoughts about, you know, what's going on with the health side? Because I know you're much more familiar with that and how this would all play with your bill.
Well, that's very interesting. I think that's a totally separate issue. They're not going to, on their health tax returns, they're not going to be probably checking this box, because they will have already written a pretty good size check the way it sounds. The other thing is you know, we're hearing a lot from folks saying that, well, we want to pay more, we want to pay more, and this just puts it right on the tax form, convenience sake, put it on there and let her go. So that's, and it'll be sitting on the House floor, and who knows where it goes from here. So
thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Lesh.
Is there a way in this bill for me to check off specifically if I don't want to pay for any portion of state government, for example, your salary or the salary of Representative Biskins?
Representative Lesh, no.
Okay, no. Set a check, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Any discussion from the audience? Hearing none, I'll renew my motion that House File 247, as the amendment, we recommend to pass and send to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Okay, I will now move House File 1084, Wisconsin Reciprocity Agreement Negotiation. Excuse me? Oh, we have an amendment, members, if you'd look in your packet. House File, okay, it's the A1 amendment. Dean, if you could please explain the amendment. Or Ms. Manzi, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the amendment makes the bill the same with regard to reciprocity provisions as House File 42, the tax bill that's in conference committee. Do you want more detail?
Any questions of Ms. Manzi? Okay, members, I moved House File 1084. We recommend pass and send to the Committee on Ways and Means. I will now move the H1084A1 amendment as just described by Ms. Manzi. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. We now have House File 1084 as amended. Any questions on the bill? Representative Lynchewski.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure if you're just setting up a vehicle here, and if you are, I don't blame you. That's certainly part of the process, but we have already passed this. But I do want to thank you genuinely for adding the language that requires that Wisconsin has to pay up first. I understand your constituents are really affected by this, and I understand why you'd want to author this. But really, Wisconsin owes us $58 million. So I really appreciate you taking that seriously, and I hope that at the end of the session, when there's a final negotiation between yourself and Governor Dayton and others, that will absolutely be part of it, that we can't go forward without that $58 million being paid back to Minnesota. So I appreciate that that provision is in here.
And Ursula and Chesky, I am very committed to that provision. I have personally spoken to the governor about it, and he has expressed his concern and his support for that provision. And so that's not something we're just taking lightly here. This needs to be done if we're going to re-enter into an agreement. Any further discussion? Hearing none, I'll renew my motion. The 1084 as amended be recommended pass and sent to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, members. Representative Bisgins. Now, you'll wonder why all the TV cameras are here. It's quite obvious that it's about House File 584 or 548, I believe it is. Representative Bisgins, if you could please present your bill. Representative Bisgins moves House File 548 be recommended pass and sent to Committee on Ways and Means. General Register. We're going to get there somewhere. General Register, Representative Bisgins, please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. In current law, if a person is raising game birds and waterfowl and they are selling them to shooting preserves for sport, that activity is counted, their property to do so, to have that activity is counted as ag land. However, if you're doing exactly the same activity, like a constituent of mine, and you are selling them to zoos, to collectors, and even to state agencies, current law, the way it is read strictly, says your land must be taxed as commercial property. This bill is seeking to rectify that, and it very specifically says if you are licensed to raise these waterfowl, then your property can indeed be classified as ag property. Members, this passed through the Agriculture Committee without opposition. It passed through the Property Tax Committee without opposition. I do have, Mr. Chairman, a spokesperson for the Minnesota Assessors Association that supports this change in law. Mr. Chairman, we're simply trying to keep people from running afoul of current law, and we'll do that through this change. And I stand for any questions.
It's going to be a long day, members. With that, any questions of Representative Bisgins? He does have a testifier that could talk to the assessor. So you said, Representative Bisgins, the Assessors Association is okay?
Not only okay, Mr. Chair, they support this change.
Okay. Okay, any questions for Representative Bisgins? Okay, with that, Representative Bisgins renews his motion that House File 548 be recommended pass and sent to the, or be passed and sent to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And
okay. Thank you, Representative Bisgins. Okay. Now we have Representative Paymar has the bill. House Representative Paymar moves House File 1231. Be recommended passed and sent to the Committee on Ways and Means. Okay. Now, Representative Paymar, to get the bill in the order you would like, you have an amendment, the A11-0273, is that correct? And members, the 0273 amendment should be in your packets.
Mr. Chair, that is the amendment, and Ms. Manzi can explain it if you have any specific questions. It deals with the conformity issues that we've already passed.
Okay, Ms. Manzi, if you could describe the 0273 amendment.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the amendment addresses two broad issues with regard to House File 1231. The first relates to the fact that when the bill was drafted and introduced, the House and the Senate had not yet acted with regard to federal conformity. since the bill was introduced, the House and Senate passed House File 79, which was signed into law by the governor as Chapter 8, which conformed to federal changes for tax year 2010 only. That bill amended several sections of Chapter 290 of Minnesota statutes. Those sections of Chapter 290 were proposed to be amended in House File 1231, and so all of those sections needed to be redrawn to be drawn to those sections as amended by Laws 2011, Chapter 8. And that's because House File 1231 also addresses federal conformity, and it proposes conforming on an ongoing basis to most federal changes. So that's the first batch of changes, and that is most of the length of the amendment. The other changes are that there are a couple of effective dates that were in the bill that were inconsistent with provisions listed in the governor's budget. Those related to the taxation of real estate investment trust dividends. That was supposed to be effective in tax year 12, and the bill as introduced had them effective in tax year 2011. The same thing happened with regard to taxation of foreign partnership income. The budget documents listed that item as effective in tax year 12, but several of those provisions were embedded in sections of statute that did several things in the bill, so the effective dates needed to be amended to have the foreign partnership income provision effective in tax year 12, while other provisions would be effective in tax year 11. Stepping back a moment with regard to the Chapter 8 provision, you'll recall that Chapter 8 also repealed the delay of refund payments from the state. That repeal of the delay of refund payments from the state was also included in House File 1231, so the amendment removes that repeal since that provision has already been repealed.
Mr. Chair, that's what I was going to say, but I...
Okay, Representative Paymar moves the A11-0273 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. We now have the bill in the shape the author would like. Representative Paymar, if it's okay with you, if you could make a few opening comments, then I'd like to go to the commissioner for a little bit. And we may be, people may think we're cutting the commissioner short here the first day. That's not my intention at all. You and your assistant commissioner and any of your staff are welcome to this committee at any time. But as you can see, we have a lot of folks that have traveled in that would like to also testify. And so we'd like to get to some of those folks if we could. And then, of course, Commissioner Franz and Assistant Commissioner Mossman will be with us throughout the duration here. So, and they're more than welcome to committee time. So with that, Representative Paymar, if you could please give us a brief summary of your bill, if you would, and then we'll go to Commissioner France, and then we'll get right into some testimony. And just for some quick ground rules here, as we take testimony, we'll be looking at 2 minutes per testifier. So if you could, you know, if you've got an 8-minute speech or 10-minute speech, kind of condense it just a little bit to 2 minutes, and we'll be holding pretty firm to that. That doesn't apply to the author or the commissioner here at this point, but we want to get as many people in as we can. Another ground rule is we do not want to have a lot of redundant testimony. If 5 people in a row have gotten up and said we really like the provision X, you just come up and say we like provision X too, and not, you know, we don't want a lot of redundant testimony, because there's a lot of, this is a bill with a broad scope, and so we want to try and get to as much of it as we can. And then my question, of course, will be if people have traveled from over 50 miles, we want to make sure that we get them down here today so that they can get their testimony on the record. And Representative Paymar is a dynamic legislator and makes a lot of good points. But the other rule will be we're not going to have applause. A lot of Paymar bills get applause. And deserve it, and deserve it, I might add. But we're really going to have to be careful of that, because, you know, some of Paymar's provisions, you might want to applause for 30, 40, 50 seconds, 3 minutes. That's going to take away time from people that could actually testify with their thoughts on the bill. So that will be one of the ground rules, that we won't be having applause at some of the comments that are made. Okay, Representative Paymar, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's an honor to be here today to present the Governor Dayton's tax bill. We all recognize that we have to make some painful cuts this year. We are prepared to work with you to do this in a balanced way that doesn't harm our state. In the last biennium, when we were in the majority, we made difficult cuts. We cut the biennial budget $1.2 billion. We made the hard choices. Governor Dayton also recognizes that we need to make cuts. The governor's budget reflects a reasonable and fair solution to resolving our $5 billion deficit. I think it's also clear that the omnibus bills that the majority passed, including the House tax bill, doesn't get the job done, were made with dubious assumptions, and inappropriately uses special revenue accounts to backfill the general fund. In fact, as the letter from MMB points out, and you should have this in your packet, your budget bills are out of balance by $1.2 billion. And in talking with Representative Carlson, the former chair of the Finance Committee and a member of this committee, your budget bill has enormous tails ensuring large future deficits. Even more disturbing is the reality that homeowners and businesses, under the majority's proposal, will be stuck with huge property tax increases, estimated at $1.3 billion over the next 4 years. You can say that property taxes are a local decision. You can abdicate your responsibility, but the reality is that property taxes will substantially increase statewide, regardless of how frugal our local units of government are. Senior citizens and families harmed by this recession will be forced to pay even more in regressive property taxes or move out of their homes. The defining issue of this legislative session is what kind of state will we be living in when we adjourn, and what kind of state we will leave our children in the future. The proposed cuts embedded in your omnibus bill will jeopardize public safety, decimate our institutions of higher education, make transit unaffordable, harm those most in need, the poor, the disabled, the elderly, and shortchange our environment and natural resources. In my view, if the cuts the majority has proposed are made, we will erode that which once made Minnesota special and vibrant, a robust economy and a superior quality of life. As a former bishop in this state once said before this body, the budget is a moral document, and that has always stuck with me. The governor's bill is fair and equitable. He admits it's not perfect and has been open to negotiating. But the governor has also said that our income tax system, and I absolutely agree with this, needs to be fair, and the severe cuts proposed by the majority will be devastating. The House DFL caucus believes in a balanced approach of tax increases, targeted cuts, and government reform. Your own members have talked about the next tax bill, the next round. Now is the time for negotiation. Now is the time for compromise. Mr. Chair, you indicated to me that you wanted to be fair to the governor by hearing this bill. Well, you heard the bill before, the February forecast, and now you want to hear it again, so here we are. In short, House File 1231 raises $2.4 billion in the general fund in fiscal year 12-13. It adds a new fourth-tier income tax rate for those that benefited the most from the 1999-2000 income tax cuts. It adds a statewide property tax on million-dollar homes. It closes corporate loopholes. What has changed since we last saw the bill? The three-year surcharge on incomes exceeding $500,000 is removed. This bill, while making hard general fund cuts, ensures that we invest in our children's future, maintains an infrastructure that we need to grow our economy, and does the least amount of harm given these difficult economic times. My hope is that we can set politics aside and do the hard work our constituents sent us here to do. Mr. Chairman, the Dayton administration has staff here to answer specific questions about his budget, the tax incidence studies, and other questions. It is now my pleasure to introduce to the Tax Committee the Commissioner of the Department of Revenue, Myron Franz.
Thank you very much, Representative Paymar, for that introduction. And Commissioner Franz started last week, I believe. That's correct?
Yes, sir.
Started last week. And so he's getting right into the middle of it very quickly, and we're very fortunate to have him before the Tax Committee today. So if you could make a few opening comments, then, members, we could have just, you know, if there's a few quick questions, Commissioner Franz will be here throughout the duration of session, and and will certainly be visiting you if he hasn't stopped by already. And so then I'd like to get into testimony from folks that have come in from afar. Commissioner Franz, welcome to the Tax Committee, sir.
Thank you, Chair Davids, and thank you for the opportunity to appear before this committee. And thank you, Representative Paymar, for your introduction and for sponsoring the governor's bill. I'm honored by Governor Dayton's appointment, and I'm honored to appear before this committee. I think one of the things that the governor has made it very clear is that his tone has been to be available to assist in any way that we can to this committee, to the chair, and going forward with this tax proposal and all the tax proposals before this committee. I want to thank Chair Davids for meeting with me several times and talking with me several times before this hearing, and I also appreciate your kind note last week on my first day. Thank you very much. Chair Davids, it's been rumored that some freshmen who bring new bills to the committee sometimes fare better when they're accompanied with food. And so there's a couple bags of food for us to share later on during the day as we run out. I thought the governor's bill should have equal opportunity with all bills introduced before the committee.
Members, I think this new commissioner will do just fine.
First of all, I want to make a couple quick notes about the department and the transition for me to be here, if you'll indulge me just for a moment, Chair. I want to thank this committee and you for indulging this transition, and I want to thank Governor Dayton for allowing me to transition from my private sector job to this job in a very reasonable fashion. But in particular, I have to give a thank you to Deputy Commissioner Dan Solomone, who has been unbelievably supportive. I know most of you know Deputy Commissioner Solomone very well. He's been extraordinarily kind on a personal level, and he's been very helpful in running the department and assisting during this transition, and I'm happy to report that Mr. Solomone will remain Deputy Commissioner. I also want to make just two comments, two more shout-outs, if you will, to Assistant Commissioner Mossman and Legislative Liaison Paul Cummings, both who have worked really hard. You folks have seen him here during the day, in the evenings, on the weekends, and they've been just unbelievable, and I couldn't thank them enough. As Representative Paymar said, we have some more folks, professionals from the department, who are here to help answer any technical questions. They've also been working very hard trying to be available to this committee as they move forward. I've had an opportunity to meet with several of the committee members before. Chair Davids, as I mentioned, Chair Runbeck and I have met. I've had a chance to meet with Representative Loon, Representative Lincheski, Representative Garofalo, Representative Marcourt, and I hope to meet with all of you in the coming weeks as we work through this session together. I want to just mention that the governor and I are very appreciative of Chair Davids and the leadership that he showed in getting the 2010 Federal Tax Conformity Bill passed, and in getting the delay for business tax refunds. The department is right now processing these business tax refunds that have been lifted, and we're also processing the new 2010 federal tax changes, and these efforts were really helped substantially by your leadership, Mr. Chair. I want to talk just briefly about the bill. Representative Paymar has outlined broadly the governor's bill, and the governor appreciates this opportunity, and I know we'll have many more as time goes forward. I know that you and I have talked, Mr. Chair, about the need for us to reach a common ground in order to reach a budget deal by the end of the session. And I know that we, in terms of the administration and the governor, are extremely committed to working with you and discussing all issues and making sure all options are on the table. The governor's bill has a balanced approach to the budget by both cutting spending and increasing revenue. It is the governor's belief that this is the fair way to balance this difficult situation, that we need to provide increased revenue over time to deal with the fact that we simply do not generate enough revenue on a yearly basis to fund the level of government that the citizens of Minnesota have come to expect. We believe that this bill offers a very real solution to the structural deficit by both cutting spending and by increasing revenue. The bill requires shared sacrifice by everybody in Minnesota, and as Representative Paymar mentioned, it does include a new fourth tier for high-income earners that will help make an important step in making the system more fair and in making it more progressive. The governor has proposed that there be no local aid cuts to property tax relief programs or to local aid to cities and counties. As a result, our estimates in the bill would result in no change to property taxes for any property tax relative to current law, and it would not shift the budget problems of the state down to the cities and the counties. The governor agrees with this committee that we must strive to make Minnesota more competitive. And along those lines, the governor proposed an increase in the research and credit, research and development credit for Minnesota activity that qualifies under that bill. I've had a chance to read Representative Bill's proposal to increase the research and credit, and I hope that we can have further discussions on this topic as we go forward. As you know, the governor's called for expanding the tax base by eliminating special deductions for certain corporate income. All the business tax changes have been made with the idea of making the system more fair, of making the tax base transparent and evenly applied to all businesses. In closing, the governor's bill was really formulated on three basic principles. First, Minnesota needs a stable and predictable revenue stream that funds state government at a level that can provide the services that we have all come to demand as citizens of Minnesota. Number two, the governor's bill provides a more fair and progressive income structure for individual income taxes. And number three, we believe that there's a strong need to provide relief from regressive property taxes for individuals and businesses. Chair Davis, thank you for this opportunity to come before the committee, and I look forward to working with this entire committee as we go forward.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner Franz. Are there any brief questions? Or I think, you know, Commissioner Franz, you'll be here throughout the duration, like I said, and I think that we will wrap up the testimony down the road. We're not going to get it all done today, obviously, with you, where there'll be a lot more member questions. But any quick questions, Representative Gottwald?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll have a lot of questions on this bill eventually, but I'll offer just a few quick ones. First of all, just to the most recent comment about stable and predictable tax revenues, I think we all know that income taxes are probably the least predictable and least stable, and yet that seems to be what we base a great deal of this tax bill on, so that's a comment. The question that I have of the commissioner is, you mentioned a level of state programs that Minnesotans have come to expect. Can you tell me what level of state programs Minnesotans have come to expect and why $3 billion in additional revenue that we're expecting under the current tax structure for the coming biennium is insufficient to meet state needs in a down economy?
Commissioner Franz.
Chair Davis, Representative, thank you for the question. One of the things that, just in commenting briefly on your point about stable revenue, certainly part of the issue that we want to make sure that we have is a varied tax approach and relying on a number of different income tax systems, not just one. As you mentioned, the more you rely on a particular tax type, the less predictable that income stream might be. So our goal, and part of the goal was in broadening the base of the corporate income tax, was to make that base more broad and more stable going forward. With respect to the level of income the Minnesotans have come to expect, Governor Dayton has made a very conscious and determined effort to go through the budget that you've all looked at and that we're all faced with, and to make some really very serious cuts to the existing budget. So I think it's important to recognize that the governor's budget proposal is based upon serious cuts and a serious change in the level of services. But nonetheless, it's the governor's belief that we require a combination of revenue and budget cuts to balance the budget. Thank you.
Well, just a quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. I mean, the governor's proposal expands state government. It doesn't make cuts. It expands state government 22%. In addition to the $3 billion additional revenue we're expecting for the coming biennium, $3 billion additional revenue, it adds over $4 billion on top of that at a time in a down economy. And Mr. Chair, I just find it extraordinary that we're talking about a responsible, balanced approach when, in fact, we're putting the majority of this tax increase on the most unstable form of revenue we have in the state of Minnesota, and adding 22% to state government at a time when businesses and individuals are experiencing flat to, in many cases, down revenue in their own family or business budgets. I don't find that balanced or responsible.
Okay, Representative Anderson, Downey, then Marquardt, and members, I think we will cut it off at 11, and not that members won't have plenty of time throughout the process here to ask questions, and then Lincheski, and then we're going to go to folks that have traveled in from afar. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will be brief out of consideration of my fellow members. But I, too, have the same concerns as Representative Gottwald has in that the governor's overall budget is increasing spending by 22%. He's not decreasing it. He is increasing spending by 22%. And one of the comments that struck me in your presentation, Commissioner Franz, was that you said that the governor is trying to make Minnesota more competitive. And I'm wondering how he's trying to make it more competitive when in reality he is going to be making Minnesota one of the highest tax states in the nation. How is that going to make Minnesota more competitive?
Commissioner?
Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. You know, the whole concept of what is competitive is a very important one. And clearly, from the perspective of the governor, we believe that it's important that businesses around the country and businesses in Minnesota can look to the government, look to the state government, and find a fiscally balanced government that's run on a level that is consistent with the revenue that the state generates on a regular basis. So we do believe that the state's finding a solid, balanced approach to the budget problem will enhance its competitiveness. Businesses need to know that they're going to be able to operate in a state environment that is fiscally sound, that's predictable, that the level of services are there that their businesses and their employees require. So it's really looking at the competitiveness of Minnesota in a broad context, not only on the tax rates, which is clearly something you have to be concerned about, but it's also based upon the ability of the state to manage its budget fiscally and in a way that the businesses can respond positively to.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner France, I think the message that the governor is sending to businesses across the state and ones that might be considering coming to Minnesota is that we have an insatiable appetite when it comes to tax revenue in the state of Minnesota, especially given the economic times that we're in right now, that we're asking to increase government spending by 22%. At a time when people can least afford it. And I think that's a wrong message that we're sending to businesses, in particular when we're competing against states that are on our borders, Wisconsin, the Dakotas, Iowa. They all have signs out saying, come to our state because we can do better by you, and we've got the workforce and everything else. And I guess I disagree with that. I get really concerned when we're going to be increasing spending by 22%, and it's just sending the wrong message that we truly aren't a stable economy here in Minnesota.
Representative Downey, Marquardt, Lincheski. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Franz, we haven't had a chance to talk, but we've heard this term balanced a couple times here, and maybe I have a slightly different definition of that. In my mind, what we need to do right now is balance what we're seeing in the private sector with what we're seeing in the public sector. And very clearly, 20-plus percent spending increases is not even close to the reality of the private sector, although I guess if you would average out a 20-plus percent increase in public sector spending and maybe the 20-plus percent decreases that we've seen in private sector incomes, net worths, and spending, maybe that's your definition of balance, but it isn't mine. And I'm curious, I haven't seen the latest runs off of the governor's revised budget proposal, but I remember what it was in the original February forecast, or the original budget that the governor put out in February, and a very small percent was actually cuts. Do you know what the actual dollar number of cuts are? And I know there were some cuts and some increases that netted out to about $480 or $90 million, but what's the dollar of cuts that the governor is proposing right now?
either Commissioner Franz or Assistant Commissioner or
Chair
Commissioner
David,
Franz?
I don't have that figure in front of me, Representative Downey, what the actual number is. I'll get that for you, but I don't have that in front of me right now.
Assistant Commissioner, or can we get that to Representative Downey? Okay, Representative Downey.
Well, Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers, I don't know whether it's 400 million or 700 million. I'm guessing it's probably somewhere in there. I haven't seen any additional cuts proposed. But clearly we're talking about a $5.1 billion deficit and maybe, what, 10% in cuts and 90% in tax increases and shifts and consuming reserves. And I don't know about anybody else here, but you can use whatever definition of balance you want, but that is not a balanced approach. I mean, the thought that somehow that's balanced in the public's eye based on their own personal experiences, let's be accurate when we talk about balance. Anybody else in this room thinks about balance, and I think they would see the scales being even, and I wouldn't support a 50-50 tax increase and spending cut proposal because I think the public sector is just massively imbalanced with regard to the private sector right now. But to come out here and even pretend by any definition that what is being proposed here is balanced, I mean, it goes beyond any definition that any one of us would accept. So I got more questions. There's some things here in the tax incidents right up from the research department at the Department of Revenue, but we can go into that later and let the testifiers get in. But let's not kid ourselves about a balanced approach here, members. This is an unbelievably imbalanced approach, and it is excessively imbalanced when you compare that to the ordinary, everyday experience of people around this state.
Assistant Commissioner Mossman.
Mr. Chair and members, Matt Mossman from the Department of Revenue. Just to kind of, and I don't exactly, there's been a couple of numbers, the 22% you know, I don't exactly know how some of those numbers are being calculated. I believe that the balance of the governor's revenue and spending changes is about 45-55, and we can get you that precise number. But I think, you know, there's obviously, just, you know, to kind of put a little context on that, there's obviously a number of things that can be included or not included in how changes in spending and revenues are calculated from one biennium to the next. I think a couple of things that are in play in this conversation. Certainly there's changes in the education area that have historically always been considered spending changes. That is where they show up in our budget area. I think the other thing in terms of the baseline from one biennium to the next, it's important, I think, to understand that we have in the previous biennium, or the biennium we're in right now and ending, and these are, you know, I think good questions for Commissioner Showalter as well, is that the state received a lot of one-time money in that biennium that resulted in lower general fund spending. So what you have is a comparison point where you have a lower base, not because the state was not providing services necessarily in those areas, but because we were funding those services with one-time resources from federal funds and others. So in terms of the comparison to what the service level change is from one reference point to another, I'm pretty sure that it's not 22%. I'm pretty sure it's much less than that, and we can get the exact number.
Representative Downey.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members, we can tie ourselves up in knots with all of the fiscal sleight of hand that goes on down here at state government. But bottom line is, we got a $5.1 billion deficit. I'm guessing we got maybe $500 million of cuts, and the rest of it is coming from somewhere else. And so when we talk about balance, let's not be deceived by the idiosyncrasies of state government accounting. Bottom line, $5.1 billion budget deficit, maybe $500 million in cuts. We'll get that confirmed. That is not balanced, and everybody out there watching knows it.
Representative Marquardt.
So thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And first of all, before I go to my questions, I want to thank Commissioner Franz. He was actually working before he became the official commissioner. He was down to Moorhead a few weeks ago and wanted to sandbag. Well, it just snowed, and it was too cold for sandbagging, and they were waiting till later. But we did go around that day, the commissioner and I, and talked to a number of residents and talked about the flooding and so forth. So I appreciate you coming to Moorhead to do that, and also appreciate the governor being in Moorhead and up and down the Red River Valley this last weekend looking over the flood situation. Members, the truth of the matter is, Representative Paymar and the governor here has a budget that is balanced with real numbers done in an honest fashion that protects jobs and protects those priorities that are most cherished by this state. And, you know, you can talk about whatever percent you want, and we've been over this before, but if you use ongoing revenue versus the one time, it's quite a different story. But the key is that the governor's budget makes cuts, changes the trajectory of spending, which we're trying to do. And it's a balanced approach. And Representative Davids, we've got a choice here. We've got a choice between Governor Dayton's plan or the plan put out by the House. And Governor Dayton's plan balances the budget in an honest way. We now know, and we've been talking about this for quite some time, that the House plan uses funny numbers and funny assumptions to get to where they're at. And you're short by about $1.2 billion. It hurts our state's jobs and hurts our priorities. Governor Dayton's proposal here, as a state, says we're going to take responsibility for solving the budget. The House plan shifts the responsibility of solving the budget back onto local units of government, back onto our senior citizens. And one of the things that I know the governor has talked about is fairness. And when you look at this bill, it's fair. It creates a fair tax system. Because what the governor does is he says that a senior citizen on a fixed income or someone in the middle class should not pay more of their income in state and local taxes than a millionaire. The House plan says the senior citizens in the middle class, you don't pay enough. That's what the House Republican plan says to senior citizens on fixed incomes. You don't pay enough. So we want you to pay more. So we're going to increase your property taxes. We're going to take your renter's credit away. We're going to eliminate your market value homestead credit. And we want you to pay more so we can protect millionaires from paying their fair share. And Governor Dayton has said that is not right. It's unacceptable. And that's what he fixes. And that's what I like. It's a fair system. So no matter who you are, you're paying roughly the same amount. And I could give many, many examples of this where we are hitting senior citizens on fixed incomes. The governor's proposal doesn't impose property tax increases by cutting local government aid. So any dollar that's raised on a property tax increase is going to be accountable and we'll know why it is. The House plan raises property taxes $1.2 billion over the next 3 years, places another heavy burden on our senior citizens on fixed incomes, our farmers, our businesses, young families. And so we have a choice here. Do we want a fair system where everyone pays equally? Check the governor's plan. Do we want to protect our property taxpayers around this state, including our small businesses that in the House bill sees a $63 million increase in property taxes? I think we go with the governor's plan. Do we want a fair system, a more honest system, a budget that's based on real numbers? That's the governor's plan. And he protects our priorities of education. So, Representative Chairman Davids, I'm glad you brought this bill forward because I think it's a great way to look at what is the vision for our state. And Governor Dayton's plans here is to make a fair tax system, protect our priorities, protect jobs, and create a base that we can spring forward into prosperity into the future. So thank you so much for bringing this forward.
Thank you, Representative Marquardt. And we're past 11 here. I'm going to keep on the list for the next time we have the Commissioner before us, Lincheski, Carlson, Gottwalt, and I'm sure everybody will have questions. At that point, we are going to get into testimony from, as I would say, real people at this point. First of all, a couple questions here just for some housekeeping. Is there anyone that has driven in from Preston or Fillmore County? Because they would go first. Anyone from Caledonia, home of Assistant Commissioner Mossman and the Mighty Warriors, or Houston County? Okay, then we will start with, And thank you very much, Commissioner and Assistant Commissioner. And I would hope, and I know you will, that you will contact members on both sides of the table here and get to know them and express what your thoughts are, and it can be more personal conversation. I think that would be very helpful. Thank you, Commissioner Franz.
Thank you.
And I'm not sure what you brought, but we will find out at noon.
It's good.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner. Okay, Mary, and I'm going to really try to do names well here. If I don't, please correct me. Mary Sassoni and Mary Ellen Dubois. Du Bois? Okay. Welcome to the committee, Mary and your other brother, Larry, wasn't it, or something? Or Mary Sassoni, Mary Ellen Du Bois, if you could please state your names for the record and who you represent, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Mary Sassoni, and I'm a parent in the Stillwater School District, and I'm also Executive Director of Parents United for Public Schools. We're a network of thousands of parents from all 134 legislative districts. Parents use us for information about education policy and funding proposals that are being discussed here in the legislative arena. Conversely, we hear from them about how these issues affect their local schools. What we've been hearing over the past 8 years is increasing concern over the annual cuts that have become norm in a seemingly endless stream of state budget deficits. We also hear how parents try to deal with these cuts locally by working to pass operating levies, and how that process has torn communities apart, as well as created a monopoly board of opportunity disparities throughout Minnesota. Expectations for our students and schools increase, but state funding remains flat. According to this handout from the Minnesota Department of Education, it's clear what's happened. While it looks like our schools have received money, it has actually been the local property tax levies that have kept our schools afloat. Today, 92% of our schools have local levies in play, and in many cases, those levies account for up to 20% of a school's budget. Also, because of action taken by the legislature in the mid-90s, those operating levies will need to be renewed. It's a really tough sell for parents to answer their neighbor's question, "What do I get if I say yes to this levy?" The parent truthfully answers, less cuts. Because unless the state keeps its end of the bargain, no amount of local levies can make up the difference. This is particularly true in many of your school districts, where the property tax fairness issue is acute. The truth is, in many, many districts, there may be a willingness to support a school levy, but there's simply not the capacity.
If you could please wrap it up.
The less property wealth you have, the more expensive it is for your schools. Without increasing state revenues, this will continue. We support Representative Paymar's bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Du Bois?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and all members of this committee. My name is Mary Ellen Du Bois, and I'm the mother of four public school students in the Osseo School District. I have come here today to speak in support of this bill as a parent who is seeing firsthand how the quality of education in Minnesota is declining. In the 11 years that I have had children in school, I have seen our district make drastic cuts by eliminating class offerings, eliminating junior high sports and activities, and increasing class sizes, among many other things. It has become very obvious to me that my 8-year-old daughter, Kaylin, will not have the same opportunities as even her 15-year-old sister, Lauren, has had when she was a younger student. During this session, I was initially excited to see the Senate and the House were recognizing the need for increased revenue for the school districts by adding $50 to the basic formula for the next 3 years. It is good to know that all the legislators that voted for that recognize the need for an increase to the basic formula for education. But then I found out where the money was coming from. Apparently, this isn't a plan to increase new revenue, but rather a plan to take $50 from a student in one district and give it to a student in another district. Looking at it more closely, it becomes clear that the plan is taking $50 from students that already face their fair share of challenges. In exchange for the basic formula going up, funds to help kids struggling with disabilities, poverty, or becoming English language learners will go down. And I'm not sure how anyone expects that is going to help close the achievement gap in the state. As a parent who is in a district who is more towards the winning side of this equation, it might be tempting for us to say we should take the money and run. But I know eventually we'll be on the losing side of one of these political battles. Furthermore, as a parent, I am not at all comfortable getting more money for my child at the expense of another child. These are the children my children play soccer with. These are the children my children will grow up with and live with for the long term. I'm testifying today in support of this bill as we'll put our public schools in a little bit better position to do what our state constitution calls for and provide an adequate and equitable education for all of our children. It is my hope that in the long run, that Minnesota will reform how it funds education. A rational formula based on what it actually costs to educate each student to meet the state standards.
If you could wrap it up, please.
Yep, would be such an improvement over the current system of funding, which feels like a shell game where money is shuffled to different areas of the state based on political power. I support Representative Paymer's bill, and I'm asking you to support it also. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Tilbury and Garofalo. Representative Tilbury.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question is for, I believe, the Parents United. I know your name is Mary. I always mess up your last name.
Mary Ciccone.
Ciccone. And the particular question that I have for you is that you talked about levies and school levies and so on, and the renewing of levies. Could you tell me what is the percentage statewide of the last levies that were passed in communities? What, you know, overall percentage when you look at schools? What how many of these levies passed? Could you give me an answer on that?
Ms. Ciccone?
I have seen 60-40. I can't remember that number. I will get that number to you.
Okay, the reason that I asked that question was, you know, if we're looking at 40% passing rate of levies, and we're asking school districts to go out to and get more levies, even in renewing their levies since they're coming up, you know, how can we expect a very positive rate if only 40% of them are passing? And I'd like you to comment on that, if you could.
Ms. Ciccone?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we would agree.
Representative Tilbury?
So, as you look at it as from the Parents United, constantly having to go out and advertise for levies, and in some respects, the state not picking up their, really, their fair share of what they're talking about, of how we're going to talk about how we're funding the schools. I guess I'm just looking at Parents United to see what their approach would be to handle this, and I'm assuming that you are for Representative Paymer's, as he brings the governor's budget forth, as more fair, especially when levies are brought into the picture. Because property tax, if we depend on that, that doesn't seem to do very well. And so if you want to comment on any of that, that'd be great.
Ms. Ciccone, then members, we have to have questions a lot briefer if we could. Otherwise, we're just not going to ask questions. Ms. Ciccone?
Mr. Chair, Representative, over the last 20 years, the per pupil formula has increased a little, it's half of inflation. Over that same time period, before 1990, less than half of your school districts have had levies. Today it's 92%. It is the single thing that parents most hate, going out and having to twist arms of their neighbors to raise their local property tax, terribly regressive, as opposed to having the state provide what the state says it does. One last comment. The state says these are the standards. The state sets the proficiency rates. The state sets the resource. The three of those really need to line up.
Mr. Chair, I have a question for you on your last comment that you made. Could you repeat that, please? Because I didn't catch that. It sounded like it was a ground rule.
No. What we have to do, members, we've got a lot of people who want to testify. And I should not have said there won't be questions. There will be questions. But we have to get the questions a little more succinct. We need to narrow them down and focus in a little bit better here, I think.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'm a little confused because the earlier people that were commenting, it sounded more like campaign speeches and sound bites than it did actual questions. So I'm just checking.
Mr. Chair, motives are out of order in committee or anywhere else, and you know that, Representative Tilbury.
Okay, I'm just saying what sounded like Representative Gottwald.
Members, please. There's a lot of speeches going on both sides. We're going to ask the testifier some questions, and then we're going to move on. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I got about a 12-minute speech I'd like to give first here before I ask my question.
You're out of order.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, and to the testifiers, we've talked with each of you about this. You've brought up the issue of the governor's proposals to raise revenue and tied them back to education funding. But when you look at the House position on education funding, you look at the governor's position on education funding, can you just give me your thoughts on what the House target is on education funding? I have to turn this into the K-12 committee. But can you just give us your thoughts on what the House target is on education? Not those priorities, but the total aggregate of spending.
Mr. Coney?
Mr. Chair and Representative Garofalo, we're very pleased that the House and the Senate and the governor have all held schools harmless in the way that they have. Absolutely true.
And Mr. Chairman, President Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, and to the testifiers, since the House position is, in terms of total spending on education, is virtually identical to the governor's, and since we're doing it without revenue increases, without the governor's revenue increase plan, why would the governor's increase plan be relevant to education funding in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Coney.
Mr. Chair, if our children only grew up in schools, there might be no relevance. But when people ask me what the most important thing is to close the achievement gap, I very simply say that they need all the support services that those other parts of the state's budget provides. Cutting health and human service for children who are coming to our schools, who are ill, or who have families who are ill, makes it just as difficult for those children to learn. No dollar amount in a school can make up for that. So while we are very supportive of the House and the Senate and the governor working to hold schools harmless, the truth is that our children do not live in a vacuum.
Representative Garofalo,
just a last question. Is it a fair statement then to both the testifiers that with regards to the proposals to raise revenue, that the amount of spending that we're aggregate spending that we're making on education finance is really not a matter of dispute in this debate? That it is in the other areas you identified?
Ms. Ciccone.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, what we're concerned with is the future. And in the future, we cannot continue doing what the House and the Senate have done to fund schools. We have to have increased revenue, or we don't have a sustainable, dependable system.
Well, Mr. Chair, Garofalo.
That was going to be my last question, but I have to ask, since we're, again, proposing virtually the same. Hey, Dras, can you move? Thanks. I'm having a difficult time understanding this because we're proposing, again, virtually the identical level of spending. I understand within that account there are different priorities and different ways of things we should fund, whether it's extended time programming or not. I understand that. But why is the plan of whether to raise revenue or raise income taxes, why is that relevant to the education finance account in this budget? I understand the case can be made for other accounts in the budget, but it sounds like we're in agreement on this, that the debate in education funding is not what we're going to spend. It's rather going to be how we're going to spend it.
Ms.
Is that a
Boyce?
Fair statement?
That is, I guess, partially true in what you're saying. I think, as Mary has said, that as a public school parent, to understand what's going on with the health and human services budget, I know that will impact. I mean, on a basic level, parents won't take their kids in to get them checked for strep anymore. My kids are going to be home with strep constantly because you just don't have the money to do it as they lose their health insurance. And I think as a parent, my testimony also is the difference in how Governor Dayton's bill would deal with the actual money collected for education distributed, and how the House and Senate bill is redistributing it in a way that's going to disadvantage students who are already disadvantaged. And I strongly disagree with the idea. From what I figured out in the history of Minnesota, parents pitting parents against parents has happened before, school districts against school districts. And I as a parent, I can't strongly say how strongly I'm against that.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chairman, I do not want to turn this into the Education Finance Committee, but for both the testifiers, thank you very much for your support of the House target and the positive comments that you've made not only here today, but in other room, in other hearings. And I just want to say that we appreciate that, and we look forward to having that debate about how we're spending that money, and that the total level of spending that's not on the education silo, that's not the debate. And I just want to say thank you for that.
Members, my vision of having a lot of testifiers today is quickly going away, and I guess that's fine. And I apologize to Representative Tilbury. I didn't mean to be cutting you off. I just thought we needed to move things a little quicker. But the testifiers, if you come back, you're not done? Ms. DuBois and...
We're not done.
No, you're not done. We're just getting going here. I have Erickson, Dabney, Lincheski, Runbeck, Loeffler, and Gottwald. Sorbson of Erickson. First of Erickson. Oh, pass. Okay, we're from Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Ms. Ciccone, I apologize. And
DuBois.
DuBois, my apologies. I was out of the room when you testified. You folks are important, but there was a constituent, and she's more important, so that's the way that works. I could tell from the questioning that you talked about levies. I'm also concerned about fees, activity fees, sports fees, extracurricular activities, things like that. And I know several years ago there was some a study done looking at the sharp increase in fees and the barrier that presented to many middle-class families of getting their children involved in those activities. I haven't seen anything recently, but I'm wondering if Parents United, as you've traveled the state, have run into concerns or issues about that, or if that's an issue going forward, say, with the growing special education cross-subsidy that we'll see under the House bill, for instance. And to either of you.
Ms. Ciccone or DuBois?
Mr. Chair,
Ms. Ciccone.
Representative Dabney, I don't have hard numbers on the study. What I can tell you is a child who's in a three-season sport or activity may be paying as much as $300 for each of those, which means somewhere around $900 to $1,000 for one child. That does absolutely ace out a lot of kids who would very much like to be part of an activity. The special ed cross-subsidy right now, it's actually Congressman Klein has said that owed to America's kids is $26 billion. Minnesota's share of that is over $700 million. So that's just from the federal government. So we're already trying to make up for the federal, and now we're trying to make up for the state and the cross-subsidy that will occur from that change. We really need to see that there's some kind of increase in revenue in the larger picture in order to sustain what we believe needs to be sustained in schools.
Representative Dabney?
Well, I think Ms. DuBois wanted...
Oh, Ms. DuBois. And before Ms. DuBois answers, folks, there are empty seats here if you'd like to sit down. Members that are, or folks that are standing. Ms. DuBois.
Mr. Chairman, as a parent, some of the feedback I hear, I have friends who live in the Lakeville District, very concerned about the increase in fees going into next year. With that, our district, Osseo District, is very diverse. Quite honestly, the participation rate, I'm assuming, on the west side of the district is much higher than on the east side of the district. Families that are living in poverty certainly can't spend $1,000 a year on extracurricular activities. And when it comes to junior high sports, you don't have to worry about that they've been cut.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney.
Just want to thank Ms. Ciccone and Ms. DuBois as well for kind of bringing in the whole kid, because that's the challenge that I feel when I sit on the K-12 committees as well as here is, you know, when I see the kids going into my children's school, in their backpacks is their health concern. In their backpacks is their housing concern. In their backpacks is their parents' employment or unemployment concern. In their backpacks is the quality of the drinking water and those sorts of concerns. In their backpacks is the concern about the quality of life and access to outdoor activities and all those things that allow them to develop as whole children. The whole kid walks in the door. The challenge for us here in the legislature is we deal with everything in silos. Today we can debate in this committee the tax policy, but it's hard for us to reconcile the tax policy with the education policy, with the health and human services policy, with the employment policies and that sort of thing. So thank you for bringing those issues in, because that's what's real for our constituents back home.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. Representative Lincheski. Representative Runbeck.
Mr. Chair, I'll pass, except to say that we continue to hear about revenue, and I wonder if there's an equal focus in your organization on spending, because that's the other part of the coin, the other side of the coin. And have school districts actually lived within their means in a decade in which we had a recession? or did they in fact exceed the money coming into their districts? And I will tell you they did, and so I'll pass after that, but I mean, except for to say that.
Thank you for passing. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'll break this piece, but I just want to make sure I understood correctly. Ms. Ciccone, did you say that in some districts up to 20% of their operating budget is these discretionary voter-approved levies?
Ms. Ciccone?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, that's according to the Association of Metropolitan School Districts.
Representative Loeffler?
Wow, that's just amazing to me. I was actually working for the State Department of Education a long time ago when we authorized those, and it was supposed to be for the extras. You know, if you wanted to have extra team sports, or you wanted to add on junior high sports, or you wanted to have more plays and trips to, you know, or whatever, and to have 20% of some budgets at the whim of the voters and their willingness to step up with property taxes is kind of amazing to me. And, you know, because this is the tax committee, I think we have to worry about that, because while it was described, I thought, elegantly as a monopoly of opportunity disparities, it's also a real disparity in the support that this committee provides to communities. Because if a wealthy suburb can pass a lot of referendums, and they tend to be better able to pass referendums than small, poor, rural communities is when I've looked at the map, is that then their taxpayers get to apply for the property tax refund and the renter's credit refund, which this committee funds, to help pay for those extras. And the small rural school district that doesn't have much of a tax base, that has people with lower income who don't feel like they can step up and increase their property taxes for those things, not only have an opportunity gap for their citizens, but they don't get the benefit of us and our tax refund program helping them out. Is that correct, Ms. Ciccone?
Ms. Ciccone?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes.
Representative Loeffler?
Thank you, and I thought Ms. DuBois wanted to
Ms. DuBois?
You know, and I just wanted to, from a parent's perspective, say I have been one of 6 to 10 parents sitting in a living room in our district of 22,000 students on 66 square miles, attempting to figure out how we're going to educate the entire district on why we either renew a levy or pass a new levy. 80% of the people living in our district do not have students in school, and it is completely frightening to me to know that a vote can be taken, and my district could lose 20% of its operating budget because we did not renew a levy, especially knowing that outside groups will come in with the sole purpose to defeat our levy, not having lived in our community.
Representative Loeffler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is an area that I hope we'll have further discussion on, but I think there's some real inequities here, and I question whether or not we're stepping up to our responsibilities to education, and we definitely need to look at why we're putting so much on property taxes and votes by most of whom don't have children in the school.
Grisham Gottwald? Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, Ms. DuBois and Ms. Ciccone. Appreciate your testimony. Next is Cindy Johnson. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
I'm Cindy Johnson, and I'm here with my daughter, Jenna Johnson. We're here to talk about the budgets to people with health and human services cuts. I just want to bring Jenna today. She isn't feeling well, but I just want the face of disability, you know, for her to be here today. The constant attack on people with disabilities and the elderly to balance the state budget crisis is just getting so hard for us to bear. Year after year, I hold my breath every year to see how badly we'll be targeted for cuts. Jenna faced a 5% cut in her support services between 2008 and 2009 in the health and human services cuts, and we're still reeling from that to try to make ends meet. Jenna needs help for everything. I mean, to get out of bed, she has her own apartment, goes to work at Target, sings in the choir at church, she's part of her community, and she has a pretty decent life. But anything that Jenna needs to do, she needs assistance. And what we're actually cutting in the Health and Human Services budget between the House and the Senate, you know, there's talk of 15%, there's talk of 20% in the Senate. It's just way too much. And worse yet, I know this is the House, but in the Senate they're talking about cutting PTOT, speech, dental, vision, and prosthetics. That proposal scares me the most because it's forcing people into managed care. And why? I just see the HMOs cutting more and more services to make revenues, and their reserves are so high. I applaud the governor's pursuit of the HMO profits this year to help with the shortfall, but there's still $2.5 billion in reserves that the taxpayers have already contributed. And I'm just wondering why we can't look at that a little bit more instead of targeting so much to people like Jenna in the Health and Human Services cuts. I never hear in the media or sound bites or anything that the revenues are down. So many people are no longer employed and paying taxes, or that revenues are down because we've cut taxes so much over the last few years. I think we're just simply not collecting enough, and it's irresponsible
If you could wrap up, please.
I'm trying. But it's irresponsible to try to solve the problem by just cutting expenditures. I think that mindset is asking Jenna to contribute way too much. My husband's a state employee, and they're also being targeted for cuts. And, you know, I'm a taxpayer. I pay property taxes. Jenna works and pays taxes as well. But we need a more balanced approach to how this is hurting people. I think just making the cuts and not looking at revenues when we're in this time is not responsible. We have a responsibility to the most vulnerable in our state, like Jenna.
Ms.
And I think
Johnson, if you please wrap it up.
The committee needs to do the right thing. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Representative Gottwald.
Well, Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers and the members, this is a debate between what the House position and the governor's budget. We're talking about the governor's budget, correct? The governor's budget actually cut services to seniors and disabled people more than the House position. The House position actually increases health and human services spending over $500 million. I also wanted to make that comment in regard to the earlier statement when we kind of wandered off of education and talked about it in very broad terms about health and human services spending. We are actually increasing health and human services spending under the House position by over $500 million. And again, if we're talking about the governor's tax proposal here, his proposal increases taxes more than $4 billion, increases state spending more than 22%, and still cuts services to seniors and disabled. So I just wanted to make sure we had that framing.
Thank you, Representative Gottwald. Representative Lincheski.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, maybe we need to have, maybe the problem is that the spreadsheet for the governor's bill is not in our packet, and maybe we need to have the Department of Revenue fiscal staff walk through the bill, because what Representative Gottwald just said is not what's in Governor Dayton's bill. And so, you know, if we're gonna hear the bill, then maybe we should actually get the right numbers here. There is not a $4 billion tax increase in Governor Dayton's bill. And I think, you know, I sense there's an urgency to hurry. I'm not sure why, but Mr. Chair, if the pages can pass this out, Representative Paymar, the author of the bill, said that this was in members' packets, and it actually wasn't. It's sitting right here. So I going way back in the beginning, and I did pass, I wanted to make sure members actually had this, because Representative Paymar mentioned that we all had it and we don't. And I think it's important for members, as we discuss, you know, the budgeting that's going on here, you know, and Representative Gottwald also just talked about the spending part of the health bill. And you know, we're in the tax committee, Mr. Chair. But the tax committee is the committee that funds all other committees. There is no place else, if the budgeting is done right, that government gets funded except in the tax committee. And unfortunately, there's a lot of revenue in other committees. And if the pages can hand this out, I think all members have been sent this. This is not new information. But, Mr. Chair, if you look at the back page of the handout, you know, the commissioner of MMB, and for the public, the commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget is the identical commissioner who was the commissioner for Governor Plenty. So, you know, the public often doesn't know. It feels like everything's partisan, but the person who signed this letter to us is the identical person who did the numbers for Governor Plenty. So Governor Dayton and Governor Plenty have the exact same people putting the numbers together, and these people, nonpartisan people, said that the numbers in the current majority's Health and Human Services bill are phony, and that the governor was not intending to solve the budget until we get the numbers right. And this document, in great detail, and we can make, you can go to the Minnesota Management and Budget website, and you can, the public can read it for themselves, says that the House has still not solved $1.2 billion of the deficit, and more to be analyzed. So I know we started out earlier, I heard Representative Downey talking about, you know, the big picture, and I didn't know that we were going to get into the big picture, but Representative Downey started that this morning, and Representative Gottwald and Representative Garofalo has talked about the education budget. And so if we're going to talk about the big picture, I think it is appropriate to understand that it is the tax bill that has the spreadsheet that doesn't say $8 billion at the bottom, or $4 billion, or $1 billion, or $400 million, or, you know, whatever. It's the one that's in the 30-plus billions, the tax committee, because the tax committee sets the revenue for the entire state budget. And we maybe need to see the spreadsheet for this bill, just like we saw it for House File 42. And I know Representative Carlson has had concerns about the permanent, ongoing structural deficit in the House proposal, and we've got the governor's proposal, and I think we should be looking at those spreadsheets. But if you look at the back page of this, members, I think we all know this budget, you can like it or not, the numbers are real. And Chair Davids, the numbers in your tax bill are real. You don't have fake revenue in your budget, and I think you have put together an honest tax bill, as has the governor's budget. But as the chair of this committee, you're in charge of the revenue for the whole budget, and these other finance chairs, these renegade chairs, or I don't know if you're in agreement with it, or, you know, if you couldn't rein them in, Mr. Chair, but they have all kinds of revenue going on, and even worse, it's not substantiated. It's not factual. There is a $1.2 billion chunk missing out of the budget of the majority. It's right here. And I know people will say this isn't true. I see Representative Gottwald shaking his head. But I want to be clear for the public. This document comes from nonpartisan staff that all the taxpayers of Minnesota pay for. These are the people who are committed to doing the most nonpartisan work possible. And it is the identical person who did the numbers for Governor Pawlenty, who is doing the numbers today, who has signed their name to this letter. So, you know, we can act like this is partisan, but the nonpartisan staff says $1.2 billion in the House budget is still missing. And let's be honest here, and I've been a supporter as well. The majority's budget and the governor's, and I did it too, has a school shift. It's, you know, the ultra gimmick. So everybody's got that. So when people want to say they've solved for 5.1, first, there's the biggest chunk of all is a gimmick. There's some one-time money going on here. There's raiding other revenues in other bills, not yours, Mr. Chair, but in other bills like state gov finance, and we've seen it in transportation, and we've seen it in Health and Human Services. And then there's, even after the school shift and taking money, having revenue raised in other communities, it's still $1.2 billion short. So I think before people get all worked up and say, you know, this group did a great job and this other group did a not so great job, I think you can be for or against what the governor is saying. But I don't think you can dispute that it's real and it's honest and it's difficult. I understand that. But before the negotiations can begin, Mr. Chair, you in the end and Senator Ortman will have to determine the level of revenue for the state of Minnesota, whether it's this or something else. And we still have $1.2 billion of fake money sitting in other areas. And I hope as we go forward in the debate, because I think it is appropriate for Representative Garofalo to talk about education, and it is appropriate for Representative Gottwald to talk about health, and Representative Downey to make his statements, and Representative Anderson. But the reason this bill is bigger than the tax area is because it funds all of state government. And you can want more or less. Governor Dayton, let's be clear, is cutting. I mean, I think there was sort of an assertion going on here earlier that there weren't cuts. I mean, really, I think that's really difficult for anybody to make that argument. I mean, and I think it disrespects all the people who are very personally and genuinely feeling those cuts. So, Mr. Chair, I know this is going to be a difficult road to hoe, but I do want the public and all of us members to read this letter carefully and think about, with 39 days to go, how folks are going to get their heads around the right number when already our nonpartisan staff says $1.2 billion of the problem has not yet been solved. And I think it's honest for folks to either pass another $1.2 billion in cuts or pass another $1.2 billion in revenue or some of both. But, Mr. Chair, you know, I do want to ask you in the process here, when the numbers get resolved, is it your intent to either raise more revenue, and I'm guessing you're going to say no, but if it is, will we get to have a hearing on that proposal to make the budget work, or will you be cutting more LGA, or will you be cutting more renter's credit, or, you know, I'm not sure, but this is the revenue committee, and we get that call, and you have the majority vote, so you get to decide, but we get to make that decision here, and Governor Dayton is not raising $4 billion. I mean, that's just not happening. So, Mr. Chair, if you have thoughts on the process going forward on how we're going to solve this missing $1.2 billion or what the process will be for this committee to ultimately get a balanced budget, I'd be interested in hearing it. And also, finally, and I appreciate the time, I do, maybe we can have somebody walk through the spreadsheet, because if members don't understand the fundamental part of the governor's bill, like how much revenue it's raising, I think we need to slow down a little bit. Even though you gave this bill a hearing another week, I mean, that's not what's in this bill. So, you know, Mr. Chair, if we can hear from revenue or your thoughts on process, I'm kind of confused.
Could you repeat the question?
Yes. And I know you're kidding around, but there's two. We need to hear the numbers. We also need to hear from you the process to resolve the missing $1.2 billion in the majority budget. So those two questions, and it really concerns me that we can be at April and we have tax committee members who fundamentally don't understand the choices and are not understanding what's in the governor's budget. And I think that means it's time to slow down and start walking through the details. And I understand there's a lot of people here, but we can't have people voting on things that they're not even understanding what's in the bill.
Thank you, Representative Lencheski, and I'd like you to know that my sense of urgency has gone. It's gone.
Okay. Mr. Chair, is it okay if the witness
Representative Paymar.
Is it okay if the witness is excused? I think
there are some more questions. I have Representative Hortman, Carlson, Loeffler, Downey. Let's finish up the witness, then we'll come back to the Lencheski question because that needs to be answered. Representative Hortman.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to keep the witnesses here if they really need to go, if Jenna's not feeling well, but it just struck me that nothing about their story indicated to me that they had caused the recession and that their family should bear a burden for getting us out of the recession and that my family shouldn't. And I was just wondering if maybe there's something I missed in the story where Cindy Johnson and her daughter Jenna are somehow responsible for the recession and the state's budget shortfall, but that's a rhetorical question, and they don't need to answer if they don't feel like it.
Well, Ms. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we've already had a lot of cuts, and, you know, what's going to happen to Jenna is way buried in the budgets. I know this is the tax committee, but we need to look long and hard at what we're doing because the cuts that are proposed in both, you know, the House and the governor's budget and all the budgets make way too much of a burden on people with disabilities. She just can't bear a 20% budget cut and still be able to go to work or even live in the community. I mean, what are we going to do, force people back into institutions? It's just craziness that we'd even consider that big of a budget cut or that big of a cut to people's services and supports. And Jenna, by the way, was injured by a doctor at birth. She didn't choose to be in this wheelchair. She didn't choose to have this, and our family has done every single thing we can. I've given up my career. We've moved. We've built an apartment for her. We have given to the point I can't even give anymore. And so what are we going to do? What are we going to do, and why every year are we back to this point that it's the people who can speak up the least that are the ones that have to bear the biggest burden? It's just not right.
People, please.
Mr. Chair, just
Representative Hortman.
Thank you, and I couldn't agree with you more. And I think that my family bears a role to play in getting us out of this budget deficit, and not just your family. And so I think that that's why I'm so glad that Representative Paymar has brought the governor's plan forward, because what the governor's plan is about is bringing all of us to share in solving this problem, and not just certain families in Minnesota.
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have a question of the witness. I was wanting to respond to Representative Gottwalt, and our lead, Representative Lencheski, covered much of it, but some of you are on Ways and Means, and if you'll recall, I kept arguing as finance bill after finance bill went through that, one, you weren't balancing the budget, and two, that you were using a lot of funny money. And the best example of that was the waivers that I requested, and it's in that memo that was just handed out from Minnesota Management and Budget of $750 million in waivers. And yet the Department of Human Services, virtually everybody outside of the majority caucus here, agrees that the likelihood of those waivers being granted is virtually nil. So you've got, in that bill alone, $750 million in funny money. Now, Governor Dayton's approach to the Health and Human Services is, in fact, honest numbers. So I think that's a big part of the debate here, and it's probably going to surface on more than one issue as the witnesses come forward. But as Representative Lencheski pointed out, and those of us on Ways and Means that we're listening at least know full well, that there's a $1.2 billion problem. And in the out biennium, and that's what I just passed out, which plays into this discussion as well, we're not adjusting the budget appropriately in a way that will reduce the deficit in the out biennium. It's $3.5 billion as provided to us by the nonpartisan staff. So you're not only not solving the budget this biennium, but you're creating a huge problem that remains in the out biennium as well. And I don't know that anybody needs to respond, but I think we have to get some of the facts here on the table.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with the to the broader conversation, you know, I think we all disagree over the extent to which the reforms we've proposed will actually work. And we know that the governor basically has said he doesn't think we can reform and get better and do things faster and cheaper and actually serve people better. He is largely saying we need to raise taxes and continue pouring more money into the existing programs and structures. And so we're having a big debate about that, and I don't think it's you know, a bad statement about anybody that we're having that discussion, and that frankly the Republican side disagrees with the governor's side over whether those reforms are going to work or not. We're convinced they are, and we've respected the fiscal notes as best we can. But I want to get back to a more particular discussion with regard to the testifiers. Because each of the last two testifiers I've heard speak to the fact that lower income people are being hurt the most, and they're the ones that are bearing the brunt of this. And I would draw members' attention to the tax incidence analysis on page 3. It's in your handouts. It was part of our packet here. And I had a question for staff just to maybe educate ourselves and the testifiers and everybody else in the audience. But if you look at the table on page 3, and maybe this is a question for Mr. Michael just to confirm, but as I look at the table on page 3, people who make $11,298 and under, our first population decile, will actually see their tax burden as a percent of income increase under Governor Dayton's plan. Am I reading that right? Is this an incidence study, kind of the overall bill that Representative Paymar has before us? This is the net impact of all the taxes in there on these deciles, and then, in fact, people at the lowest income range will actually see their tax burden increase?
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Downey, yes, that is accurate. That if you look at the right column, that shows the essentially the tax burden as a percent of income as a that changes as a result of the governor's tax bill.
So, members, and to Mr. the testifiers, Downey? Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to the testifiers, you aren't able to understand this and probably even see the information. But what we're looking at is a chart, and it goes down by the income groupings that we measure things here in the state, and somebody making under $11,298, perhaps that even includes your daughter, we don't need to have answers to that question, but those people's taxes will actually go up.
What I'm
under Governor Dayton's bill.
Representative, is thank you. What I'm concerned about is the cuts to the health and human services budgets that were set by targets. The amount of money that they have to cut and the way those cuts have shaken out is her budget could have potentially be cut 15% or more. So what she makes, there's no way she can make enough to provide herself with the support she needs and the services she needs. If we cut 15% of her budget, she won't be able to live where she's living, go to work. That's what I'm talking about.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And I appreciate your circumstance. And don't get me wrong. What I'm trying to do is provide a generalized education to people that the impression created by comments and the author of the bill, even in his opening comments, is that somehow this is the fair way to do it. And you can actually look here. Somebody making between $99,000 and $142,000 will see an actual smaller percentage increase in their overall tax burden compared to people making $11,000, $18,000, $26,000. And so this sense that the governor's tax bill, while it does really nail people in the top 1% and the top 10%, the sense that somehow it's making the tax burden smaller for lower-income people is not true. It actually increases taxes across the board for everybody in Minnesota. And, Mr. Chair, if I could ask you a question, maybe it's for staff. Do we have the same table for the chair's tax bill that we actually passed? Do we know what the percentage change in taxes would be under your bill? My guess is that it actually would go down at those lower-income levels based on the income tax changes, but I don't know that for a fact. Do we have this same table for your bill?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Downey, yes, a very similar analysis was prepared for the House tax bill.
Mr. Downey, I personally would like to see that at some point. I probably just missed it in hearings. But, members, the point here is it looks really good to demagogue the rich and talk about balance and fairness. The reality is the House Republicans passed a bill that actually reduces taxes on the lowest income individuals. Their income tax rates go down. And here they're going up. And Representative Bills has talked about what's happening with the money supply and inflation. And so the sense that somehow lower income people are going to have their lives improved by virtue of this new tax policy, when we focus on the tax bill here as it stands, everybody's taxes are going up. Everybody's in this room, your taxes are going up under the governor's budget plan.
Would the sergeant at arms please remove the person? Please remove the person. Representative Downey, you have the floor.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not trying to drive that much anxiety in people, but clearly this representation that people in the lower income area are going to have a better situation under the governor's tax plan. Their taxes are going up. The tax incidence table here shows it. They will pay more in taxes under the governor's bill.
I believe the witness needs to go. Is that correct?
And okay. I'm kind of scared what's going to happen. I mean, what's going to happen at?
Okay. Thank you very much,
committee, for hearing us.
Ms. Johnson, thank you. Thank you for being here. Members, we have a lot of folks to testify. Please take a look at your emails for the next tax committee meeting. Representative Lincheski?
Mr. Chair, just a question of clarification, because I can see you're writing to either adjourn or recess. I genuinely meant, and you said we'd come back to it after this testifier, so I hope we can start with that. Representative Gottwalt said something about the governor's proposal, which is not accurate. And now Representative Downey just did as well.
What part do you think that Ripsel and Chesky,
well,
as far as the tax increases, if you look on page 3 for 12, 13, 14, and 15, you're looking at $1.3 billion, $1.1 billion, $1.1 billion, $1.1 billion.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Ripsel and Chesky.
Because what was stated was the governor's budget versus the majority budget, and the bills fund the full budget. And so, you know, Mr. Chair, this is a factual statement, and I stand to be corrected after we come back. I don't know if we're recessing or whatever. But the majority bill cuts taxes by $140 million. That's true, on net. And to do it, it raises $64 million on the bottom 60% of the income. $64 million of to get $140 million in cuts. By contrast, the governor's bill raises $941 million because it's a tax increase, not a tax cut. These are apples and oranges, first of all. But to do that, it raises taxes on those same 60% of households, getting a $941 million tax increase, $35 million. So the majority has to raise taxes $64 million on the bottom 60% to hand out a tax cut, and the governor is raising almost $1 billion, but only touching those 60% with $35 million. So if we're going to go through this committee with the public and the press, people need to have the facts here, and I really think it is worth walking through the spreadsheet when we come back, because there is not a $4 billion tax increase in Governor Dayton's proposal. And when you look at just the spending side, you know, you might fall into this trap, but the revenue raised by the governor pays for the progressive programming, and you can't look at the budget in isolation. It's paying to not cut to not raise students' tuition, and to not cut the U, and to not cut Jenna, and to not cut local governments, and to not hurt the disabled, and to not do all these other things. You have to look at it together. And I hope we can have a factual discussion. I have the analysis of House File 42 that Representative Downey is asking for, and we were all given that too. And I have it for the Senate, and I have it for this bill. And I'm starting to worry that the Tax Committee maybe isn't preparing for Tax Committee hearings, because I think we need to know the facts here, because we're being televised, and people are saying things that aren't. We all editorialize, and we're all subjective. That part, that's fair game. We all do it. But when people say things that are absolutely incorrect, I think it's only fair to the public that we get the facts from the nonpartisan people. And I really hope we're going to walk through the spreadsheet when we come back.
And Representative Lancheski, we are very well prepared. Representative Downey.
Well, just Mr. Chair, maybe I am agreeing with Representative Lancheski. It'd be great to look through the tax incidence analysis. That was what I was referring to in that chart. So perhaps we need to have staff walk us through that too, so we're all operating on the same basis.
Okay. The hour of 12 o'clock having arrived, members, this discussion will continue. I have a whole bunch of people on the list to talk. We're not going to be able to get to, and I apologize for that. But this discussion will continue. It'd be my intention to call a meeting after Easter break to come back, and I think I will take the advice of lead Lancheski, and we will walk through spreadsheets, and we'll have a lot of member discussion. And then we will be having more testimony from the public. So the process continues. I'm sorry we weren't able to get to everybody today, but it will continue, and we will get these things on the table. It's a very important bill. Representative Paymar, thank you for presenting your bill today.
Mr.
Representative
Chair,
Paymar.
Mr. Chair, I think this was really...
Members, good government all the time. We are adjourned.